Russian President Vladimir Putin sang the national anthem alongside thousands of Russians in Moscow's Red Square on Wednesday to mark the first anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. A year after that momentous event, with Putin and his supporters toasting their genius in pulling a fast one over on the international community, what did NATO and other intelligence officials miss a year ago? Major General Gordon Skip Davis, NATO's Deputy Chief of Staff in charge of operations and intelligence for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe, says the taking of Crimea was something out of the blue, or you might say, out of the old red of the Cold War.
The events of a year ago are quite seared in my mind because I had been in the job about 9 months, and we were very much focused on Ukraine writ large due to the events that we had seen unfurling as early as November the previous year. We had gotten to the point we were briefing it almost daily and watching what was happening between the Maidan protesters and Yanukovych's government. And then, of course, 22 February was a bit of a surprise when he fled. And then shortly thereafter, activity in Crimea, flights going in, helicopters, little green men, which we later called them, but unmarked soldiers popping up as early as the 26th and 28th inside Crimea.
Given what happened in 2008 in Georgia, why would we ever have believed that Vladimir Putin would in some way respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine as a sacrosanct border on any level?
Well, I don't think before the events of late February 2014 that we believed that Russia would violate them. So I put it on the other foot. I think that we continue to expect and still expect, you know, Russia to meet its international community obligations and meet the security agreements to which it's a signatory. And there are many which they've violated to date that are really essential to European security. Looking back and as we continue to try to understand Putin's psychology, I think now, you know, he's established a trend that has us all very focused on what he could do in the future. And so much of what we're doing right now in NATO and have been doing over the last year is focused on responding to which now is a potential threat, that Russian military capabilities and then violations of sovereignty posed to the alliance.
Well, bearing that in mind, and also the words of your colleague, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, that Putin looks like he's, you know, signaling that he might be interested in violating the territorial integrity of the Baltics, what assurances have you given or has NATO given to Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia that the NATO agreements are absolutely inviolate and that NATO would come to the defense of the Baltics under any circumstances?
Well, that's a great question. That's really been the focus of NATO since early March of last year. And we immediately embarked on a series of measures that we called assurance measures with a number of key objectives, obviously to assure those allies that felt most threatened based on their geography, two, to demonstrate the resolve of the alliance, to demonstrate the defensive nature of the alliance. In other words, it's defensive, not offensive towards Russia. And finally, to deter aggression or threat of aggression from others. But on that latter part, in terms of deterrence, we immediately worked on a series of ideas to improve our responsiveness and our proactivity, and promoted those ideas to the heads of state and government last September. They were approved. And in fact, we're now at the end of a design stage of going through all those concepts and putting the facts and figures against them for the nations to agree upon.
Okay, I know you can't give away specific details because of security and intelligence, but are the principles, and I remember the Cold War, I mean, are the principles here, do they include the stationing of NATO troops on the borders in the Baltic states? And I remember in the Cold War, deterrence involved the invocation of strategic forces, nuclear forces, because the Soviets at that time had a huge advantage in the number of troops, just like the Russians have now. What are the principles here?
Well, That's a great point. First off, with respect to presence, what the Allies have decided on is a persistent presence in the East, not a forward stationing. NATO continues to respect its part of the NATO-Russia Founding Act, which is that we're not going to station significant forces in the former Soviet Union of Warsaw Pact countries. And so what we're doing is basically ensuring we have the capability to rapidly reinforce. And the structures that are already there, we're assuring that they're appropriate to allow for rapid response and rapid deployment. We've also increased our training and exercise activity in terms of scale, capability, and interoperability. So it's more focused on the potential for a regional defense response if that's required. With respect to strategic forces, NATO remains a nuclear alliance. We have maintained our nuclear force capabilities, and we can continue to maintain the requirements for a potential NATO response if required.
General Davis says the Kremlin's behavior is part of a larger, longer lineage of what's known in Russia as maskirovka, military deception, which translates literally to a little masquerade, techniques that surprise and deceive the enemy in a way that in many ways is enabled by the Russian media and its ever-churning propaganda machine. Maskirovka, General Davis says, is something we should be prepared to expect once again from Russia in the future.
I would say yes, they're absolutely capable of employing the maskirovka techniques in the future. It's a systemic mindset that they have really ingrained, internalized for the better part of a century now. It predates World War I, but it was most, well known in World War II and beyond. But their desire to and their ability to integrate all their elements of national power into a design which masks their intent, masks their actions is critical to them, because they believe that influences adversarial and the international decision making. So they work along all lines of effort. We would call them from diplomatic, informational, with their state controlled media and propaganda, with their military, both unconventional and irregular support, and then of course economic levers wherever they can use that for their influence. And so we can already tell by their signals that they are willing to use certainly maskirovka, but unconventional or regular means to achieve their aims of maintaining influence in countries where they're concerned or they already see westward orientation or integration.
Major General Gordon Skip Davis is NATO's Deputy Chief of Staff for the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.